Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Thursday, August 8th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Who is Your Abba? Paternity in the Gospel of John, Jesus and the Religious Leaders in Chapter 8. Presented by Paul Palumbo. The tape number is PAP 2002-04. Let's listen in.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. We offer, O God, our hearts in humble prayer before you. Offer the world to you for its redemption through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Well, today we're looking at the 8th chapter of the Gospel of John. The 8th chapter is really full of stuff. So I think the heart of it is where I want to get to eventually is the great text that we read at Reformation every year, right? Where Jesus says, if you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. They answered, we are descendants of Abraham and have never been slaves to anyone. What can you mean by saying you will be made free? Remember that? And Jesus goes on to talk about the contrast between the slave and the son. This is read at, I think, every Reformation service. This is the text. So I'm going to get to that, but I have to back up and get a running start through the 8th chapter. So we'll start in verse 12. As you know, the first 12 verses of chapter 8 is that wonderful story of the woman caught in adultery, which it's really one of the best chapters, best stories in the Bible. Unfortunately, it clearly wasn't in the Gospel of John from the beginning. Arguably an original story of Jesus, but simply not in the Gospel. So there's no reference to it until the 900s being in John's Gospel. So unfortunately, it probably wasn't. What a great story. But we're not going to talk about that. Except to say that we're not going to talk about it. What we are going to do is, in chapter 7, Jesus was at the festival of booths, or the festival of tabernacles. And at the festival of booths there in the temple, there were these wonderful lights, torches that were lit as part of the ceremony, which is the context in which Jesus proclaims, "I am the light of the world." Okay, there's these lights on, to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, and in response to those lights, Jesus says, "I am the light of the world." Interestingly, he doesn't say, "I am a light in the world," which would be interesting enough, you know, a guide or whatever. No, he says, "I am the light of the world, the one that illumines the world." Okay? So it's not just one light, any old light of the world. Now, Jesus, in John's Gospel, Jesus and John use the word world a lot. And when you hear that, what do you hear? I'll read you a text and see if I am from above, you are from below, I am from above. You are of this world, I am not of this world. And that's in verse 23 of chapter 8. So what do you think that means? What have you thought that it meant?
I was almost
Yeah, cosmos is the Greek word.
The created universe.
The created universe, okay? All right. Everything, all of it, right? And to say that Jesus is, that the, Jesus says to the people who he's arguing with, you're of this world, I'm not of this world. So Jesus is not of the created universe?
He was before the creation.
Ah, so he, in some way outside of that creation. Okay. Any other?
From another dimension.
From another dimension. Yeah. Okay. Anything else people have in mind about the world? There are, I wrote a few things back here that I think we ought to look at real quick. Which one of which I forgot to put on here, which I was going to say, which was creation. Okay. All right, which was mentioned. All of the created world, the created, anything that was created, certainly we mean by world, right? Also, planet, sometimes we'll talk about the world and think of in terms of this world, the planet. Sometimes we'll use the word world and we'll think of the entire universe. And all of those are legitimate translations for cosmos. There's another translation for cosmos and another use of cosmos, which I'm going to say is John's most specific use most of the time. Okay? When Jesus says, well, I mean, when John says, for God so loved the world, I think what he meant was all of it. Okay? But when he says, I am not of this world, you are of this world. And when he says, the world does not know me, or if he, when he says to his enemies that let's see, let me give an example. You are of the world. Well, that the one I just read. You are of this world. I think what he's talking about very, very specifically is this one. Society and its underlying forces. The dynamics of power in the world. Who's in power and who's not. Walter Wink uses the phrase, what is the word he uses? He uses system of dominance. I don't know if that's what dominance. How do you spell dominance? A-N-C-E or E-N-C-E?
A-N-C-E.
I had it right. Ha! I think if you can only spell a word one way, that's a sign of a lack of creativity. But anyway. what Walter Wink calls the system of dominance is how John uses the word world, cosmos, most of the time. This word shows up, on my count, about 77 times in the Gospel of John. Most of the time, it's very negative. There are a few places, and you can think of the places, where it's not negative. For God so loved the world that he gave his son, right? Okay, and so it's a... And that, you got to say, well, God loved it. God created it. God loved it. But most of the time, when John talks about the world, he's talking about this system of dominance, of domination. Okay. And we've seen it. We've seen it in the woman at the well, for example. The whole system which would say to Jews, you cannot talk to Samaritans. You cannot talk to women. Okay? That is part of the world, as John uses it, as the system of domination that keeps things the way they are and keeps the people in power in power. Okay? Are we all right? Is that understood? You got to look on your face like you're not getting it. Is that, are we okay? We got it. Okay, good. All right. Okay, so when we talk about the world in chapter 8, and when John, when Jesus and the Judeans have this big conversation, it's actually a mini trial. Keep this in mind, okay, as the backdrop for it. And let's, I had a conversation at Brett just a few minutes ago about, that made me think about this, about I was talking to a fella who's doing rural ministry in Minnesota, and he said this incredible tragedy of his parishioners, this generation of people who lost the farm, right? And they feel so guilty and inadequate, as if, you know, my grandfather could do it, my father could do it, but I couldn't do it. All right? Well, was that the fault of that guy? Heavens, no. I mean, there are tremendous forces that are at play. And this generation of farmers simply could not, it was just a tidal wave of forces that made it impossible for them to maintain a family farm in the way that their parents and grandparents did. All right? And that's the kind of things that we have to keep in mind when we're talking about the world. Okay. Yes.
I think there might also be an allusion to something more than what we might call the human world, because it seems to me that Jesus and or John have referred to the devil as the prince of this world.
Oh, yeah. We're gonna see that. Yeah. Okay. So Diablos. We're gonna see this word in this text, right? Yeah, absolutely. You're gonna get right. That's absolutely at the heart of what we're gonna talk about. Okay. But that doesn't mean that there are that doesn't mean that the. I guess what I would say is that doesn't mean we're talking about these spooky spirit things, right? We're talking about the devil within these systems of domination that have explicit manifestations. Okay, so powers and principalities are real things. Okay, they're hard to get your hands on them, but they're real. They're not things floating around. Okay, but you're right on it, because that's exactly what we're going to find out. And the question in chapter 8, I picked this because right here is where we get the greatest contrast about fathers. Okay? Who Jesus claims his father is, who the Judeans claim their father is, the people who want to, the people in power, religious power, claim their father is, and then who Jesus claims that their father is. Right? So there's all these different claims and counterclaims about their father. Okay. So there at the Festival of Booths, Jesus calls out to the in verse 12, "I am the light of the world, and whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." And the Pharisees said, "You are testifying on your own behalf. Your testimony is not valid." Remember back at the beginning when Jesus exercises the temple, and what does he say? Or what does the narrator say about Jesus? He doesn't need any testimony from any human beings, thank you very much anyway. Okay. And of course, you all know the reason Jesus didn't want a testimony from anybody, right? Because people are just no damn good. Right? And so, here, he's testifying to himself. And they argue. They say, legally, you can't do that. He says, whether I can or whether I can't, uh, Even if I testify on my own behalf, my testimony is valid because I know where I have come from and I know where I'm going. All right? I know my source from whence I come and I know my ending. And that is the true Father, the true God. But you do not know where I come from or where I'm going. You judge by human standards. I judge no one yet. Even if I do judge, my judgment is valid. For it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. In your law it is written that the testimony of two witnesses is valid. I testify on my own behalf, and the Father who sent me testifies on my behalf. There, you need two witnesses? Here they are. Me and God, the Father. They said to him, where is your Father? I'm running through this because we're going to get to this, but this stuff is kind of nice background. Where is your Father? Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. He spoke these words while he was teaching in the treasury of the temple, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. The implication being, this is incredibly offensive, but miraculously, no one arrests him. Again, he said to them, I'm going away and you will search for me, but you will die in your sin. Wow. Anybody remember Jesus saying that before? And when I read that this week, I thought, oh, I think I skimmed over that before. Probably my own self-preservation or something, you know. Nice way of self-editing there. Where I am going, you cannot come. Then the Jews said, is he going to kill himself? And I think that's kind of ironic, isn't it? The very religious leaders who are going to scheme and put him to death. The fact is, yes, he is going to hand himself over to death, but it's going to be a death at the hands of the very people who are speaking here. Is that what he means, where I'm going, you cannot come? He said to them, you are from below, I am from above. You're of this world, of this system of domination, I am not of this system of domination. I told you that you would die in your sins, for you will die in your sins unless you believe that I am. Unless you believe, ego eimi, I am. Okay? They said to him, who are you? Jesus said to them, why do I speak to you at all? It's great. There's some translation of variance in this. It can be, I've been speaking to you since the beginning. I think it still has the same exasperation. All right? I mean, what in the world? I've been talking to you guys now for 8 chapters. And you still don't have a clue. I have much to say about you and much to condemn, but the one who sent me is true, and I declare to the world what I heard from him. They did not understand that he was speaking to them about the Father. So Jesus said, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will realize that I am he. Again, he uses the ego in me, and that I do nothing on my own, but I speak these things as the Father instructed me. And the one who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, for I always do what is pleasing to him. As he was saying these things, many believed in him. All right, now, now we're getting to where we want to be. Okay, so he's got this argument going, and there's some testimony, and then there's some challenge of that testimony, and then there's response to that. There's some rebuttal. So this is kind of a little mini trial going on here about Jesus. And in the midst of this little mini trial, some people start to say, well, he's making some sense. Well, I'm interested in this. Okay? And then we'll see whether that plays out or how it plays out. Okay? So everybody ready to go? Any questions?
What verse are you on?
Okay, that's a very practical question. I am now on verse 31 in chapter 8. Okay, all right. Then Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." If you continue in my word. Now, that's a great connection with yesterday's story about the Samaritans. Remember, because yesterday that the woman brought this whole community of people to Jesus, right? And they said, stay with us. And he stayed with them for 2 days. Right? And that, it seems to me, is a model for the idea of abiding with Jesus, having Jesus abide in the community. Man, that invitation, stay with us. We're hungry to hear more. We want to know more. The same verb here. Jesus invites these folks. If you abide, if you stay, if you remain, if you hang out with my word, all right, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Free of what? Free of the system of dominance. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. And their response, and it might be our response as well. They answered him, "We are descendants of Abraham." Fill in Luther there if you want. Or fill in. We are children of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. And have never been slaves to anyone. What do you mean by saying you will be made free? Okay, so two things. First of all, you've got this contrast between the Samaritans, and you're supposed to go, Samaritans, right? Between that community, which invites Jesus, stay with us for 2 days, tell us more, we want to know more, we're hungry, we're thirsty. And this community, which says, what you talking about? We already got it. We're not slaves to anybody. We're not slaves to anything. And now, ourselves. What are we slaves to?
The culture.
Okay, the culture. Let's talk about that. What about the culture? What's in the culture that we're a slave to? Let's go ahead and list some things.
The media. The media.
All right, let's see. All right, we got culture up here. Or as I like to say, culture. We have the media.
Work schedules.
Consumerism.
Work schedules. Work time, because I don't know how to spell schedule.
Affluence.
Uh-huh.
Well, our history.
Our history?
Yeah.
Ooh, all right. Say a little more about that.
Well, we are told mm-hmm. that we are free people, best in the world, all that. And so we're kind of then feeling we're better than others.
I got a word for that. How about propaganda?
And tradition.
Pride.
We've got these traditions, like Fiddler on the Roof, everything was tradition.
Tradition. Yeah, and sometimes I think tradition feeds
into
that.
Yeah, it feeds into that.
And someone said something else.
Pride.
Ooh, pride.
Our own actions.
Our own actions. Actions, I'll get those down. Maybe we'll come back to some of these. All right, actions.
Our legal system.
Legal system. All right.
The hierarchy of wealth.
A hierarchy of wealth. Oh boy. Hierarchy of wealth. Okay?
Our personal emotions, anger, laziness.
Okay, our own emotions, huh?
Humanity.
Our own emotions. Holy mackerel, you guys. I didn't think we were slaves to this many things.
Individualism.
Individualism.
But we said it as a duet.
Yeah, that's really nice. I like that.
Narcissism.
The political system.
Yeah. Political systems. And what was the other one over here?
Narcissism.
Come on, you guys. Narcissism. Is that right? Is it narcissism? Narcissism. That's not
right. Never mind.
Never mind. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Okay. Okay. Here are the things that we now know that we are in some way slaves to. These are all sort of what do I want to say? Abstractions, in a way, aren't they? I mean, they're abstract. Maybe what we could do that might be helpful is get at a specifics. Maybe somebody has an example of a few of these that we can actually sink our teeth into, because you know you can't really sink your teeth into being caught by propaganda until you hear a story about how that works. So maybe somebody has a story.
I'll tell you a story.
Ah, thank you. One.
Well, I'm because of my actions, mm-hmm. something I did, I'm enslaved now by the legal system. Those two things should be like almost, because there's something I did wrong.
Right.
Now the legal system has me like, well, I can't say, but.
But we all can imagine.
They got me pretty good.
Yeah.
Say that just because of an action, so you got to be careful with your actions. Make sure you make the right ones, and I chose to make the wrong ones, so now I'm enslaved to the other one, the legal system.
All right. Yeah.
They're all connected in some way. It's mm-hmm. part of a bigger system.
Yeah, I think the legal system in some ways guards all this other stuff.
Yeah.
All right? Makes possible some of these things. You gotta have a system of laws that allows for these other forms of slavery. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any legitimacy to them. But this legal system adds great legitimacy to some of this stuff.
Let's widen out that same story.
Uh-huh.
Let's take Juan, put him as head at Enron. He'd have a nice house in Texas, nice house in Florida. Uh-huh. He'd still be running around in society. He'd have done a much greater wrong to much more people. And with better lawyers, etc., he'd still be walking around and people be still saying nice things about him. And he'd still have...
He changed his houses too, I bet.
So that's the hierarchy of wealth. In other words, the legal, your actions aren't the same if you're in the hierarchy. President Bush can talk about, oh, you bad CEOs, and if he did the same thing years ago, well, it wasn't the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because I'm president of the United States. Hmm. If you lose your job because of an action, Juan may lose a job because of an action. If you lose the presidency, oh, that's enough of a, that's enough, you paid enough.
It wasn't illegal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that everything is consequence of the political and economical system.
You think that all of them are consequence of the economic and political system? Wow.
I think it's financial and industrial complex. You know, like you said, military industrial. I think it's financial and money.
Mm-hmm. So you think that it's not just the political system, but it's also the wealth, and I'll put another one up here, corporate.
It is all connected in the same
sure.
philosophy.
Okay. Yeah. It is very, very connected, and it's all, it's a, have you all, you talked before.
I was just going to say that the cultural system and the legal system, they
they interplay to give us a very defined view of what's real and what's right. So for instance, it's clearly illegal and I could be arrested for peeing in the park.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only not illegal, it's encouraged. In fact, the president says it's a good idea if I go buy a new SUV and pull a 3-ton trailer behind it and live a life of consumption that absolutely ruins the planet. In fact, this is good for the economy.
Mm.
And so the legal system puts in place
the legal system
a really twisted view
of what's
right and what's wrong.
Right. The corporate and the political systems combining with the legal system make things look really weird. When you take a step back and look at it, when you're in it though,
it's impressive. It's, you might be able to take some advantages from the system too.
Oh, I think almost everybody in here, absolutely gets great advantage from it. Yeah, I mean, if you're not a person of color, if you're not poor. This is like water for a fish, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
This is simply what we live in. And we're not slaves.
I think that hope is for, we could come up with even a more lengthy list of things,
mm-hmm.
but we sit like the Pharisees, what the hindrance is that we're separated from God, that there's a gap,
mm-hmm.
and we are you could put the whole package under that gap,
mm-hmm.
that's what keeps us prideful, that keeps us money hungry, that keeps us supporting a legal system that is unfair is because we have that gap, that there's sin, and that we can't, though the prophets come amongst us, we still say, what are you talking about?
Mm.
Because we still don't get it. We still don't see it.
Yes, absolutely.
Jesus called it right by its name. He said, everyone who sins is a slave of sin.
Right. And
why call it anything different?
Yeah. Well, maybe we call it something different because sin is a word that's become it's churchy.
Right.
And yeah. Well, maybe not doctored up, but presented in a different way so that you begin to see it differently. Because when I hear sin, I hear of, I got angry. I got, I got a little extra change and I didn't take it back. You know, these little things that you do, or I had a bad thought, that's part of it, but there are bigger issues, there are issues that I don't see when I think about the word sin. And so I think the word, looking at the world, when Jesus talks about the world in a negative way, he's talking about all of this stuff as it is alienated from God.
Is that like the fish in the water? It looks all familiar and right to him, but this fish doesn't realize there's dioxin and PCBs in the water that are poisoning him just as he's swimming around happily.
Yeah. Good. Okay. No. Right, yeah, that's true. Okay, so we have these things, and these are the things that to which we are enslaved. Some of them, okay? Even though it doesn't feel like it. Just like the children of Abraham, it's a little easier to see somebody else, you know, when they say... the children of Abraham saying they've never been enslaved to anyone, apart from being historically wrong, it's absurd. Yeah.
I think it's like culture shock. If you take a United States person and put them in another culture, You say, see how loving, caring all these people, how much they share even though they don't have anything? Mm-hmm. And you come back to the United States and you're overwhelmed by the culture again. I think it's only when you're drawn out, apart. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, you need that wilderness experience to get away. Then when you go back in, it's like, whoa, what a place. It's the acculturation, it's the getting used to it, it's putting up the shield, it's the not noticing anymore.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes Jesus so annoying. Jesus continues to say, did you notice that? Did you notice that? Did you notice that? And we want to go, just leave me alone. I don't want to notice that stuff. Yeah. So, returning to the text for a second, they answered him, we are descendants of Abraham and have never been slaves to anyone. What do you mean by saying you will be made free? Jesus answered them, very truly I tell you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. Okay? The slave does not have a permanent place in the household. The Son has a place there forever. So if the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed. Now, one of the things that that happens when the Pharisees claim to be the heirs of Abraham, when they claim to be the chosen ones, when they claim to be the people of God's favor, they already indict themselves. Okay? They indict themselves in the oppression of the poor by way of the temple economy. They indict themselves in the ethnic separations that they encourage. They indict themselves even in the attempt to kill Jesus. All right? So when they're making this claim, hey, we're children of Abraham. We are the true faithful. Jesus says, well, that kind of true faithful, by claiming that kind of identity, you're also claiming the sin of that identity. And so he says, when you're a slave to sin, that you will be a slave to those sins. Okay? So, in other words, the world that the religious elite has created, all right, that world alienated from God, they're going to hang on to it. And Jesus says, "You want that? Great, but when you claim that, know that you are indicted in its sins and in its slavery." Makes you think twice about what denomination you claim to be a part of. Okay, so if the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed. And again, we talk about being free from this system of alienation from God. I know that you are descendants of Abraham, yet you look for an opportunity to kill me. Here's a strange thing, Jesus says. The children of Abraham are seeking to kill someone who speaks the truth. Huh. Never would have thought of Abraham. I declare what I have seen in the Father's presence. As for you, now this is interesting. As for you, you do what you have heard from your father. Now some of you have a different translation than that, don't you? What is
this is not what Abraham did. You are indeed doing what your father does.
Okay.
King James, ye do that which ye have seen with your father.
Okay, good. All right. All right. Seen or heard? Yeah. Okay. So what do you think Jesus is getting at here? You do what you've heard from your father.
It's all you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what you know, but what who are they hearing from?
The devil.
The devil.
Ah, so you all read ahead. Yeah. That's what he's implying here. Your father is not the same father that Abraham had. They answered him, "Abraham is our father." Jesus said to them, "If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing what Abraham did. But now you are trying to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. You are indeed doing what your father does." Right? Not what your father did way back when. You indeed are doing what your father does, has always done, and continues to do. Very interestingly, the disciples don't want to go there. The Pharisees, the Judeans. You are indeed are doing what your father does. And they turn back to this business of illegitimacy, huh? They said to him, "We are not illegitimate children. We have one father, God himself." Well, at least they're finally catching on a little bit to the imagery. Before, they couldn't even figure out what Jesus was talking about, the Father. All right, but now that God himself, Jesus said to them, and here's the heart of the matter. "If God were your Father, you would love me, for I came from God, and now I am here. I did not come on my own, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot accept my word. You are from your father, the devil, and you choose to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him." Who's your father? Whoa. Who is the father of this system?
Oh, you would say Abraham Lincoln or George Washington, but if you went back to that time, they were in a different time. They were of God. We argue that God shouldn't even be part of it, and we should stop offending people by bringing up God all the time in public places. They were frugal. We are anything but frugal, most of us. So even our founders, our people who we say we're like, we're unlike. They wouldn't recognize us in terms of our society. So even if we were like our founders, we're not. Mm-hmm. We're not the same kind of people that they were, as much as we'd like to think we are. They would recognize the society as one that they started. So that's part of the deal. We try to say we're like and we're not. We don't want to admit to what we've become and how we strayed from the vision.
But they were frugal by necessity, not by choice.
Actually, most of them were frugal by choice. I understand what you're saying, but I'm just saying that that's at least the belief system. They may not have been enslaved at all, too.
Okay. Yeah. Hang on one second. Let's see what... Yes.
I think St. Paul did the best understanding of the culture of death. Ephesians 6, mm-hmm. where he said that we are not fighting against person, but we are resistance again that the person incarnate, because the person do not incarnate the life of love. The person incarnate the culture of death.
The person, it might be easier to look at Ephesians 6, because I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. Do you want to look at that?
Yeah, I'm looking. If you want to read it.
Yeah, let's do it. Because I'm not, there's something there, but I can't quite, I'm not sure if I understand.
Can you tell me about it in verse 12?
Ephesians.
Struggling with the
Ephesians 6. Six, 6:10.
Okay. Okay. Finally, be strong in the Lord, starting there. And in the strength of his power, put on the whole armor of God so that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For our struggle is not against enemies of blood and flesh, but against the rulers, the authorities, against the cosmic powers. Of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. That's what you're getting at? Yeah, right, exactly. Our struggle is against the cosmic forces. The cosmic forces. Not some kind of something way out there. Something way, way in here. Even in us, huh? Of which we are a part and which is a part of us. Yeah.
It's culture of that.
Yeah. It's the culture of this. Yeah. It's the culture of those powers. Alienated, separated from God.
That's it.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes?
I think that's a really important point, because the struggle that Jesus is talking about, if it's anywhere, has to be within each of us. And Jesus himself, in a hyperbolic way, sets himself as very different from these people. You have your father is the devil, my father is God. But if you look at our list here, Jesus himself ate fish caught by people who were in this system, ate food prepared by women who were expected in a patriarchal system to... I mean, Jesus himself, as a human being, lived and benefited and was sustained in his body by this system.
Right. There is no doubt that these systems are very, very necessary in the world. Luther's Kingdom of the Left, right? Where you this stuff, anywhere you got human beings, you're going to have these. You're going to have these structures. Okay. The nature of these structures, however, is very important to discern. Walter Wink says that God created these structures. These structures are fallen, and that these structures are redeemable. And that the structures are redeemable is the work of the church. Okay. So, yes.
And I think that in many of these things, although the devil can work through these things and how we interpret them, but many of these things also help to free us, like history, tradition, and our legal system. A lot of those things are for our benefit, if properly interpreted.
Yes,
but
okay.
The devil will enter in to try to get us to misinterpret and twist and put spins on things to try to see it his way.
I'm going to write down, everybody okay if I erase these here? Okay. And I'm going to try to remember the words that you said, because that's exactly the point. If properly interpreted, oh, I'm running out of ink. Interpreted. Okay, if properly interpreted, our history, for example, our lives. Now, what is the proper interpretation of history?
to learn from it so we don't repeat errors that cause us to fall, but rather to lift us up.
Uh-huh. Okay, to learn from it, right. Okay, yeah.
We as human beings don't know what's proper, what's best for us, and to put our faith to God, to be guided by Him. And we can intellectualize and do whatever, but we don't know. We can't predict what's best for us or our children.
Okay, we can't predict what's best for us because we've made so many choices.
Right. In our history, it's human nature.
Yeah. It seems a little bit like Ralph Nader, you know, when he first came out with Unsafe at Any Speed, he made the argument about automobiles. He said, people said, you know, people, it's people making bad decisions. It's not the safety of the automobile that's at issue. And Nader just bombasted that argument. He knocked it out of the water. He said, do you understand how many hundreds of thousands of decisions you make when you get in your car and drive 25 miles? How many decisions are going to be made? Hundreds and thousands of decisions that you're going to make. Any one wrong decision, you're going to have an accident. It's you don't even think about that, but he brings that up. And historically, interpretation can be that way too, right? I mean, you know, there's all of these ways of interpreting, and there's no way that we can get it right exactly, is what you're saying, right? Okay, hang on to that, and you had something.
Yes, the properly interpreter is the uncontextually understand, because we understand according to the spirit, not according to the...
Ah, okay, according to the spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. What I'm gonna suggest, according to the spirit, what I'm gonna suggest to you is this, that the Gospels are the first texts, right, that interpret history explicitly from the perspective of the victim. And there was a hushed silence over the crowd. Right? That culture and history is always interpreted, or at least had always been interpreted, through the righteous majority or the most powerful, right? The gospel stories resist that temptation to interpret history that way. They say that the way to interpret history is by watching this guy on the cross. That's the way you interpret history. That's the way the Christianity, through the Spirit, with the help of the Spirit, interprets history. And if we are to interpret history rightly, if our Father is in fact God, the way we interpret reality is by hearkening to the voice of the victims, so that no action will be interpreted until the voice of the victim is heard. So we were talking, I was talking with Bob Ekblad the other day that in a couple, maybe in 100 years, Christians are going to look back at us and they're going to go, what were those guys thinking? Just like we did, we look back on, say, the whole issue of slavery. And we look at the church 200 years ago and we go, what were they thinking, right?
Or witchcraft,
or, you know, any number of things. The Inquisition, you know, all of that stuff. And maybe in 100 years, you know, Bob's experiences with prison, there, in 100 years, our grandchildren are going to go, what were they thinking throwing all these young men into prison? I mean, what in the world were they thinking? All right? Because
the Spirit is driving us to interpret history through those who are the victims of the action. So no action can be properly understood unless and until the voice of the victim of those actions is heard. Yes?
Doesn't that all, in a way, boil down to do unto others as you would have others do unto you? Because that allows everyone to have a look at what the effect is going to be on someone else of what we do.
Sure, very nice, yeah. Uh-huh. It does, but from a larger perspective, we've got to understand. As Christians, it's not even that we have to do this. We do this naturally. I mean, we always find sympathy for the victim, don't we? I mean, almost to the point where we get tired of hearing about it. But that's the way, that's how Christians are nurtured. It's our story, it's in our blood, it's in our soul. Because that's our story. It's the story of that man who hangs on a cross, the victim. And so there's no way to get around it. And in fact, we should be affirming it. Yes.
I wanted to quote somebody who I admire in our state government in Minnesota. He's going to become the majority leader of the Senate. He's our local state senator, John Hottinger, in southern Minnesota. He was hearing a lot of talk about personal responsibility. A very pharisaic attitude where you bang on those who aren't meeting up to what's their personal responsibility. He said when he grew up in a Christian household, personal responsibility meant the inward look, am I meeting up to my personal responsibility? It wasn't how you judged your neighbor. He said, how you judge your neighbors, you look at your neighbor, you say, how you doing? He said, not well. He handed over the food, the resources, whatever, to help your neighbor out. He didn't bang over their head personal responsibility. So it's a different viewpoint, and this is from somebody who's actually engaged in policy making and things like that. So it was interesting hearing from somebody who's at least ethically involved in these decisions to see we're judging our neighbor too harshly and we're judging ourselves too lightly. Mm.
Unless you've been a victim, you don't really know what the victim is like. I mean, you can't know someone else's experience, really, personally.
No, that's true. But you can open yourself to hearing. I mean, I think yeah. having folks around who, and part of this is, I was telling somebody the other day that. I kind of cringe when I say this, and I know it's going to be on tape and everything. But my own experience is if I want to experience Jesus, well, there are certain places Jesus hangs out. Mm-hmm. And if I want to experience Jesus, I got to go there. And it's always among marginalized people. So for me, the idea is, all right, I want to experience Jesus in a real way. I'm going to go where Jesus is hanging out. All right? So, no, I can't know what it's like to be a Nicaraguan campesino. I don't know what it's like to be a homeless person in Durham, North Carolina. I don't know. I don't have that experience, but... Man, I want to go hang out with those folks and hear from them and let them tell their stories. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. We can't know, but we certainly can be open to hearing.
And how many people want to do that?
I don't know. Let's have a show of hands. How many people want to...
Oh,
this is a different group. That's right. Never take a poll at Holden Village. Yeah, yeah, because you're going to be totally screwed. You had something, yeah.
Well, I had just at the risk of being it seems like where this gets a little tough is that the very people who advocate what I don't advocate, that is, they're the most severe about, we want to lock them up, we want to do this, we want to do all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Always do so by saying that they're doing so because of the victim.
Exactly.
You know.
That's how imbued we are with that spirit. Our whole culture is infected with the gospel. All right? You can't do something without it being justified by protecting the victims. Hitler couldn't do anything. He had to create this whole myth of victimization in order to do what he did. That's interesting, isn't it? Because otherwise it wasn't going to fly. Because everybody's too interested in the victim. But if you can say, you guys are the victim, and convince them, oh, well then, okay, then it's okay. But even people doing evil have to justify it by way of protecting the victim.
So the question is, who is the victim?
Exactly.
You can turn it around, so you say we haven't been the victim, but we can look at it. Yeah, we're a victim. We pay all these taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Corrupt people, these welfare women, we're out squandering.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen, brother. I know. We white males aren't going to take it forever. Right? Yeah, but that's the temptation. But we will have to create a subculture of being victimized, or a subculture of victims, in order to do that. Otherwise, it's just not going to fly. Yeah.
To oversimplify, I know, so bear with me. But I think we're all victims. Just reading the paper every morning, you hear about these children who are murdered or taken or kidnapped, and then you leave your house. And I think we have to download before we leave our house, because I see a stranger and I see my child, and then I have this cultural paranoia. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like we're all victimized. I mean, we hear so little, we hear so much about this violence when overall, you know, I have to always challenge myself. Like, I took a month camping trip with my 12-year-old, her and I. And if you're expecting grace and you're expecting love from people, I swear you're going to get it. I mean, yeah. And so I think we're all victimized to this horrid, I don't know what you want to call it. You know, it's us. And then how we have to cleanse ourselves several times a day from this, so we're not judging strangers by what we read in the paper or whatever.
If I may use the Johannine term, we are all slaves.
Yeah.
We are all enslaved to this whole system.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, miners were really, really strong people, really, you know, very physically able to do just about anything. And but they used to carry a small canary down in the mines with them. Mm-hmm. And that weak canary would indicate to them when they were in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, in our society, there's a book written by this, there are all sorts of canaries
mm-hmm.
that if we only take a look at them, you know, we can see things that are happening to them, you know, like the black families and the structure of different minority groups, that when they start crumbling and falling, it's an indication to us that our, you know, superstructure society is also crumbling too. And I think in some sense, if you look at those victims as an indication of what's wrong with you, you benefit by that.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. That it's only a foretaste of what's to come.
Right.
Yeah. Hmm. Yes.
I think that there are a big difference looking God over the cross than through the cross.
Uh-huh.
Because Jesus said, who wants to be my disciple, love his cross and follow.
Yes. So not looking over or beyond the cross, but looking through the cross. Luther said the true theologian is the one who studies Christ crucified, right? And the theologian of glory speaks of other things. I was trying to think if there's one other thing that needs to be said here. We just didn't even get halfway through. Never mind. Thank you all very much.